So this is a poem some of you have heard before. A particular reason why I'm chosen to have it tonight, so I will explain. This is by a Norwegian, I think he's Norwegian, Scandinavian anyway, Gunnar Ekloff. It's called Aya Asma, which evidently is a wish, not a wish, but a healing, the cult of a healing well. The cult of a healing well, Aya Asma. The black image, framed in silver, worn to shreds by kisses. The black image, framed in silver, worn to shreds by kisses. All around the image, the white silver, worn to shreds by kisses. The very metal, worn to shreds by kisses. Framed in metal, the black image, worn to shreds by kisses. Oh, the darkness in our eyes, worn to shreds by kisses. All we wished for, worn to shreds by kisses. All we never wished for, kissed and worn to shreds by kisses. All we escaped, worn to shreds by kisses. All we wish for, kissed again and again. So there's a particular story, it's not a very long story, behind that poem, or when I first heard that poem. And it relates to this little picture that I put up here. This is a picture of myself and a very dear friend of mine called Savannah Prabha, and it was taken on a retreat, a Buddhist retreat, a month-long retreat in Devon, in a field, which I led with Savannah Prabha. She was from San Francisco, and probably most of you know I spent little 8 years in San Francisco, came back about 13 years ago, I suppose now, but anyway, and she was probably my closest friend really, perhaps other than the guy I went out there with. She was a very close friend of mine in San Francisco, and we kept in touch, and we used to, when we could, do retreats together, because we so much enjoyed working together. And on that retreat, which was the first 4 years, 4 years ago now, I suppose. Is it 4 years ago? I don't think it is, because Karma Shida did it. Anyway, that doesn't matter, but anyway, I think it must be nearly four. But anyway, on that retreat, she was about 48 at that time. And she was bleeding a little bit from her vagina, and she didn't think anything of it really. She thought, I was hitting the menopause. And when she got back to San Francisco, she went to a gynecologist or whatever. Anyway, it turned out she had an extremely rare form of cancer, which evidently they only used to get like two or three cases a year of in the whole of North America. Very rare, form of cancer. And she was diagnosed as having stage 3 cancer. And she died about 2 years later. And before she died, last year she died. Oddly enough, she died when I was doing the same retreat, Buddhist retreat, which we planned to do together. But obviously, she wasn't able to do it, and it was quite an emotional thing for me because I'd promised her I'd do it. Come over and do a funeral, but I'd also said, well, in the middle of this month-long retreat, I don't know if I've got time. So we agreed that, but anyway, she died when I was on that retreat. That's the point. But why she came to mind tonight was when I was thinking of transformation, I started to think, well, who do I know that I feel was really or did really transform themselves? And it was Savannah Prabha who came to my mind, actually. Because even though before she got ill, she was already a very kind of remarkable woman in a way. She was a very sort of creative woman, very big-hearted, very much from the heart, you know. But she had quite a dark, depressive side to her, which she struggled with all of her life, actually. And it had various, you know, flirtations with drug use and depression and so on. But she also had this amazing exuberant energy to her, but slightly sort of ungrounded in a way, slightly sort of manic. She could be quite manic. And when she got ill, she stayed in her community. She lived, we used to live together, not in a sexual sense, but we lived in the same building for most of the time I was in America. And that was above the centre, a bit like this. We had more room above the centre. We had a small men's community that I lived in with three other men. And she lived on the top floor with a couple of other women. So it's like six or seven of us, depending. Living above the centre, and we always had a lot to do with each other. Anyway, she stayed in a community in her community looked after. I say looked after, but the very interesting thing was actually she spent the last 2 years of her life actually looking after everybody around her. And when I went out in July, and she died in September, so she was still reasonably so healthy in a sense. And the cancer by this time was completely spread all over the body. But she was still able, you know, to get out. And I don't know how to say it without it sounding like a cliche, but she was just absolutely sort of radiant. That's kind of radiant. And something had just dropped away. and that whole sort of rather depressive, stroke, neurotic side of her. I just dropped off. And it was very interesting. I mean, I saw this myself. People would come to see her, you know. And now just... find themselves or end up just opening their hearts there. And she just sort of in this, she was just in this kind of state of grace, really. I don't really know how to put it. And I talked quite a lot about to her about it, you know. We sort of talked about it, we talked about death, and talked about how she was, how she was finding it. And she was just, I mean, obviously, you know, she had a difficult time doing that, but on the whole, she was, as I say, just kind of completely open and radiant. With something, as I say, something let go of, you know, something let go of. And so, it's a funny thing, really. And I've seen this, I mean, I was already kind of familiar with this phenomenon. Because for 6 years I'd worked in a hospice when I was in San Francisco. I mean, I just worked there one day a week as a volunteer. In the Zen hospice, and I'd seen it quite often with people near death, but I'd never seen it over such a kind of protracted period, you know. And from a Buddhist perspective, of course, I don't really want to interpret it, but you know, the obvious thing that's happened when people accept that they're going to die if they manage. Because I've also seen people not accept that they're going to die, and in when they are dying, you know, clinging on and becoming more and more kind of clenched and tight. But actually, it offers a possibility of this kind of letting go, you know, offers this possibility of no longer needing to hold on to this sort of constructed self, I suppose, you know, if you put it in Buddhist terms, you know. And so I was thinking about that, and I started to think, well, what in my own life has been the most... kind of transformative experiences of my own life. And I mean, obviously there's been various transformative experiences as one goes through life, but... Settle down at the back there. I think of what has been the most transformative experience of my life, and I'm not sure this is true, but in recent years at least, and with actually a history running through the whole of my life, as the most transformative thing for me has been a process that I'm involved with, of going blind, you know, and... And this made me start to think, actually, we very often think about kind of transformation. And I think this is totally legitimate, you know. We might think about transformation as kind of improving things or perfecting things or as a sort of gaining, you know. And I don't want to sort of rule that out. I just want to suggest there's another way of understanding this process of transformation. And in this sense, it's a process of becoming more and more comfortable or at home with your own vulnerability. I think for me, this has become how I understand what I'm involved in, really, is this process of trying to open up to my own vulnerability. And I say this is this thread of my eyesight has run through the whole of my life, because even as a young boy, I was poorly sighted. You know? So when I went to school, I don't really remember it at primary school so much, though I do have this memory of some period wearing a patch over one eye and the attempt to try and get the other eye to function. But I do remember, you know, all through particularly more as I got towards puberty, I think more. I was a very, as a young kid, I was quite physical, robust, physical sort of kid, you know. And as my eyesight kind of deteriorated, you know, I was wearing these like really thick lenses, glasses. And that sort of side of me, in a way, I became less able to sort of participate in sport. So it sort of had quite a profound effect on my personality. But what I remember about it most strikingly, at some point, and as I say, I suspect this was around puberty, but maybe I particularly associated with sort of going to secondary school, so that'd be about 11 or so. What I remember about it most was this sort of sense of shame that I started to have around it, and this kind of compensation, you know, this way of trying to, in a way, trying to ignore it, I can't really explain, but I would get extremely embarrassed if anything about eyesight was ever kind of mentioned, or, you know, I feel this kind of, well, I think, I don't know what other words to use, but shame, really. And actually, for a lot of my life, for a lot of my adult life, in one way or other, I've tried to kind of hide it or compensate for it. And loads of you are here on Sangha night, Sangha day. But whenever it was, and I was talking a little bit about Adler, and of course I didn't really go into this aspect of Adler, but Adler's whole sort of theory of psyche is the sense of self forms around what he called organ inferiority. Some aspect of yourself which is vulnerable, where you experience your vulnerability. The self kind of forms around that to try and protect it. I find this a very interesting way of looking at the formation of self, or some aspects of the formation of self. Anyway, maybe it doesn't account for everything, I don't mean it, but In Adler's view, the inferiority often leads to a kind of overcompensation, superiority complex. Anyway, that's a bit by the by, but I suppose at some point something changed in me, and I don't really know when this was. It wasn't like a eureka moment or anything. It was just a gradual process of which I feel I'm still very much involved with, it's not like sort of complete, but this sort of gradual process is kind of opening into or softening into actually how I was, you know, or how I am, you know. And my experience of that, I suppose my experience of that is that the more I'm able to do that, the more kind of connected I feel, both with myself but also kind of with the world, you know. Mm. But somehow there's a softening into what's vulnerable in us, what we might kind of be living our life to compensate or hide or think we need to get rid of, or, you know, it's what's it's the sort of unwanted in us, the despised or the shameful, however you want to put it. A lot of our, I think a lot of what we do in life is this attempt to kind of compensate for that, but I think there's a different way of being in the world, and it's a way of vulnerability, of allowing oneself to fill into and come into relationship with it. And just as with Savannah Prabhupada, you know, in a way, I know from talking to her that those last 2 years of her life were the happiest years of her life.
Yeah.
I think that's fair enough to say. And it was because, you know, she'd accepted something. You know, she'd accepted her basic vulnerability, which is, of course, death, you know. Which, of course, we all share that, you know. And so I think there's a transformation, you know, transformation to be had by softening into our impermanence, if you like, if you want to put it in the kind of Buddhist terms, you know, a softening into what's vulnerable in us, which is us. You know, we are by nature finite and vulnerable, you know, but softening into that allows something to open, you know. Yes. So there were two of the things that occurred to me. Three other, they occurred to me just this evening, actually. The three other things that I mentioned that are slightly more fanciful. When I first started, when I first got all transformation, there were three things that came to my mind initially. First one was Lou Reed's, I think it was 1973 album, Transformer. So just word association really, but I'm a bit inclined to do this, if a kind of image. I mean, it came as sort of an image, if you like, but this is sort of people remember that. I'm sure it was a huge album at the time, wasn't it? Produced by David Bowie, who, interestingly enough, has been hugely influenced by Lou Reed earlier. Lou Reed worked with Velvet Underground, so a huge influence on Bowie. So it's kind of this kind of reflection between the two. So Bowie was very influenced by Lou Reed, and then Bowie then went and produced that album, and then Ronson, you know, Nick Ronson, the guitarist of Spiders from Mars, or whoever they were called at the time, also played a huge part in that Lou Reed album. He plays guitars, keyboards, backing vocals, did his string arrangement for Perfect Day, and on and on. So Barry and Ronson together had a huge input in that album. But when I started thinking about it, I thought one of the interesting things about that album, and I remember that album coming out, and it was a particular time in pop music, and what was going on at that time was this kind of there was a lot of gender bending at that time. The Bowie before that brought out Hunky Dory, which
still that.
Ambiguous, more of a hermaphrodite type of sexuality, you know. And Lou Reed in Transformer kind of had that thing going on, you know. I had it going on a little bit in The Velvet in a way, but it came out a lot more fully in that Lou Reed album, which was very, again, well, you know, very, the genders were being very bent, I don't know how else to put it. And I thought, well, this is quite an interesting thing, because I think one of the other things we identify with, either negatively or positively, some of us identify with it kind of in a kind of negative way or positive way, is our sexuality, you know. And in particular, whether we're masculine or feminine, this is like a basic kind of dualism. And in a sense, you can see it as sort of standing for all dualism, you know. It's this basic dualistic idea of being masculine or feminine. And I think, well, this is quite an interesting way of understanding transformation as well. It's the realizing in a way that though you happen to have you happen to be born female or male, actually in a way you possess those other qualities as well. You possess those opposite qualities. And I think for us, one of the ways we can understand what we're trying to do spiritually, to use that word, is to try and break down that kind of dualism in ourselves. And say, I think a lot of our idea, our construction of self, is around gender and sexuality. Trying to allow whatever's hidden. Again, it's this idea of what's been hidden, really. So I think, you know, quite often the sort of you know, we're not really in touch with either, you know, if we're male, we're not necessarily in touch with the qualities of the feminine, and if we're female, we're not necessarily in touch with qualities of the masculine, and somehow there's a sort of tension, I think, in a lot of people, you know, where they haven't quite come into themselves fully, sort of over one side. You know. So anyway, that was just thinking about that album, and the next image that came to mind, I thought, well, those little, and actually you probably got to be a man. Well, that's a terrible sexist thing to say. And actually, you've probably got to be a man of a certain age to really have a I was going to say erotic relationship with this, but I don't know why I'm using the word erotic. But so when I was young, you don't really get them anymore. If you had a train set, electric train set, or your friend, or a skate electric, you remember skate? Some of you remember. You also had a little grey metal box with silver terminals on it, which was Transformers, you know. And of course, Transformers, what a Transformer does is to step up or down the voltage, you know, I guess, right? In the case of scale, stepped it down, but anyway, so it changes the voltage. And I thought, well, this is quite an interesting image as well, in a way. And it relates a little bit to what I was saying in the shrine room before we meditated, you know. and I think this idea that energy can be transformed, I quite like this as an idea. I like the idea that situations have a certain energy, like cities. London as a city has a very different energy from if you go out into the countryside or if you go to a small town. They have a different kind of vibe to them, they have a kind of different energy to them. And one of the problems we have, I think, about in our lives is that sometimes our energy, quality of our energy, or the rhythm of our energy, the kind of tempo of us, is somehow out of, in, it's not in accord with where we are, or the people we're with, or the place we're with, and I don't know really where to go with this, other than to say that I think it's quite important that we start to have a kind of intimacy with different qualities of energy that we can have, and we try and actually find a way of being that's appropriate to the situation, because otherwise we're always in conflict with it. Yeah? So we find, you know, we find London oppressive or too busy or da da da, and it's like somehow we need to find a way of matching our energy. We can't expect the world to match up. You know. I was particularly... Oh, no, I won't go down that route. That'd be a rant in and of itself. And, that was the second image. And there was one more image, which just this moment, it's just gone completely out of my head. But we'll come back in a minute. No, it's gone completely out of my head. Sorry, I can't remember what the third one was. I had three. The third one's completely gone. Oh, well, never mind, eh? It might not come back. Anyway, I think that's all I've got to say, really. So, I just kind of leave it there. And I thought, well, you know, we can just have a bit of a chat, perhaps, around some of the things I've said. And, see how respond to it, yeah. And if I remember the third one, I'll bring it in later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This isn't what I was going to say, but I did also want to say, and I don't know why I feel sort of compelled. Nearly, this has become a bit of an obsession with me lately. And this idea of icon, and that poem is presumably about an icon. Yeah, you know, if you go to Greece or any of these Orthodox countries, you know, Christian Orthodox countries, very often the icons are framed in that very light silver. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's almost tinny, isn't it? And I spent over the years now, and then I've gone to Skyros quite a bit, Sifnos quite a bit, and Sifnos, one of the Greek islands, and it's famous for, it's quite a small island, very beautiful island, and it's famous for having a church for every day of the year. And the whole life of this island is still quite undeveloped, but the whole life of this island is around icons. All the festivals seem to be around moving icons from one place, usually by boat, one place on the island to another place on the island, and it's a great honour to have these icons in these churches, but they also have these icons that people have in their homes for a year, and it's a great honour, you know, to be given an icon. Special icon to have in your home for a year. And I don't know if people know this, but I don't know if this is going to tie in with anything you were saying here, but I think it will tie in somehow. I don't know if I can make the connection, but in my mind it ties in. Yeah. One of the main, perhaps even it's fair to say, the the main theological rupture between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church was around icons. So the Orthodox Church, the Greek and Russian Orthodox Church, they say that God or the Divine, the Holy Spirit, is in the icon. It's in the icon. And the Roman Catholic Church wouldn't have this. And they said, no, it's just pointing towards the Divine. You know, it's just but the Orthodox Church insists that it's in, actually in the icon. And what this meant, what this meant was that in the Orthodox Church you've got direct access to the Divine. Yeah. It doesn't have to be mediated by a priest or religious. You know, if you're religious, you've just got this image. And in the actual image is God. Yeah, in the actual image is God. And I suppose it relates to what I'm saying in a way, because I feel one of the basic movements of the psyche, if we can use that word, the psyche or the self, is to start to realise that the self is in everything. Yeah. So we don't have a God in Buddhism. We don't have a creator God anyway. So we can't have God in everything, but you can have consciousness in everything. Yeah. So I think one of the shifts, which somehow to me has got some relation to this, and I don't think I'm going to attempt to explain why, but for me it's got some relationship to this idea of vulnerability. To make oneself vulnerable is to sort of open yourself up to the world, you know, as it is. But it also seems to me to be somehow to recognise that the world is alive, yeah. It's not a dead world. Yeah? It's an alive world, both not only other people and animals and things that are obviously alive, but everything in the world becomes icon in this sense. So the world becomes iconic. You know, you live in this world which is alive, and it's alive in the same way that you're alive in. You know, so the separation, this kind of hard-held self, the way we kind of hold ourselves off from life, or hold ourselves away from life in some sense, this sort of desperate attempt to what is it a desperate attempt to do? I don't know. Hold on to ourselves. I don't know. But that starts to kind of waver. It starts to kind of that distinction starts to sort of evaporate in a way, and yourself is not any longer something which is self-contained. It's not some kind of kernel or hardness in you, but it becomes dispersed in everything. Yeah? It's somehow the self is... This is... In Buddhism, there's the mind-only school, consciousness-only school of Buddhism, which was developed in China. And Dogen says something, doesn't he, that the self is in the mountains, in the rivers, in the trees. He puts it rather better than that, but you know, so this idea that the self is somehow in everything, you know, it's a bit like the idea of the divine, but we're not going to use the word divine. We're not allowed to use that word. So consciousness, call it mind or consciousness, is somehow, and the whole, another way of understanding this perhaps is to understand that the whole world, everything arises in you all the time. Yeah, everything that you it's like, in the end, these things are so trite, in a sense, because it's entirely obvious that everything you've ever experienced, everything you're ever going to experience, arises in your mind. Yeah. But when you think about that from a certain perspective, it means that the whole world, if I say Australia, that's arisen in your mind. Yeah. Or when you go out in the street, that's arising in your mind. Everything's arising in consciousness. Yeah. So everything's arising in you all the time, and the corollary of that being, of course, you are arising all the time in the world, just as the world is arising or co-arising all the time in you. So this is, so I suppose what I'm trying to say is, I mean, again, we all know this, but, you know, the basic transformation in Buddhism is not to accumulate anything or gain anything, but it's allowing something to dissipate or drop off or fall away. And what is being allowed to fall away is this kind of protective shell of self. You know? Just to allow it to fall away and just find yourself in this very open, joyful, but at the same time vulnerable place. And that only falls away, I think, when you do come into relationship with your nature, you know, your true nature. And, from a Buddhist point of view, of course, this is most easily done through coming into your impermanent nature. Yeah? This is your true nature, your impermanence, kind of fragile, vulnerable, temporary, nothing fixed in you. And there's a way of softening into that. So there's no, it's not a transformation into something. It's a transformation in the sense of it's a letting go or a softening or opening or something, I suppose. So, anyway, so I leave now. I thought of the third image, but I still haven't, I'm afraid. So, you have to do about that one. Okay, I'm going to shut up now. We'll see if any of you have got anything to say.